Carissimi fratelli e sorelle.
Dear brothers and sisters, with deep sorrow I must announce the death of our Holy Father, Francis. At 7:35 this morning, the Bishop of Rome, Francis, returned to the house of the Father.
The world mourns the passing of Pope Francis, and we consider his life and legacy with the Papal Posse, Father Gerald Murray and Robert Royal, and later, Catholic League President Bill Donahue is here. We'll take a look at a new documentary about the life of soon-to-be Saint Carlo Acutis with executive producer of Roadmap to Reality, Jim Wahlberg. The world over begins right now.
Now, Raymond Arroyo.
A warm welcome to all of you joining us in the United States and the world over. An important show for you this evening as we move through the papal interregnum toward the conclave that will soon elect Pope Francis's successor. If you'd like to comment, send me an ex post. I'm at Raymond Arroyo and at Arroyo Grande Show on YouTube.
At 7:30 a.m. Rome time on Monday, the 21st of April, just a day after Easter, the Vatican announced the passing of Pope Francis. The cause of his death, of course, heart failure brought about by a stroke. And as we in the entire world mourn his passing, we pray for the repose of his soul. And tonight, we'll take a look at that 12-year pontificate and analyze Pope Francis's legacy with the Papal Posse, editor-in-chief of thecatholicthing.org, Robert Royal, and canon lawyer and priest of the Archdiocese of New York, Father Gerald Murray. Can you believe, gentlemen, that it's been 12 years since we were in Rome covering the conclave that elected Jorge Bergoglio, the 266th Pope of the Roman Catholic Church? So it's fitting that we once again come together first to mourn him and then to watch and report on this incredible event that will happen in Rome. A lot happening at this moment in Rome. Pope Francis's death was certified by the Camerlengo this week. That's the papal chamberlain, the administrator, if you will, Cardinal Kevin Farrell. The papal apartment was sealed, the fisherman's ring broken, and the general congregation meetings of the College of Cardinals are already underway. There have been several days of those, and that's basically to plan the papal funeral scheduled for Saturday, April 26th, and the adjacent events leading into the start of the conclave. Gentlemen, thanks for being here. And before I begin, I want to share the words of retired Archbishop Charles Chaput about the passing of Pope Francis this week and get your reaction. This certainly struck me. He said this: "I have personal memories of Pope Francis that I greatly value. He devoted himself to serving the church and her people in ways that he felt the times demanded. As a brother in the faith and a successor of Peter, he deserves our ongoing prayers and for his eternal life in the presence of the God he loved." Having said that, an interregnum between papacies is a time for candor. The lack of it, given today's challenges, is too expensive. In many ways, whatever its strengths, the Francis pontificate was inadequate to the real issues facing the church. Those are the words of Archbishop Emeritus Charles Chaput, formerly of Philadelphia. When I read that, I thought, these should be our watchwords on the world over: a time for candor. So on this episode, I want to honor Pope Francis's legacy. I want to talk candidly about where we are because of it. And let's go back first, gents, to the when we covered the interregnum and the conclave and we saw Jorge Bergoglio become Pope Francis. I remember being in St. Peter's Square on CNN when the news first broke and he first emerged from that balcony.
Fratelli e sorelle, buonasera.
Bob, Father, let's first consider the public face of Pope Francis. The media is filled with stories about how humble he was, his simplicity. Tell me about the public image, and then we'll get into the record. He was the first Jesuit, first Latin American pope. Father, handicapped the image the public absorbed, really right up until the decision to be buried at St. Mary Major and just have his name there, you know, no other papal designation or coat of arms or anything. I'll let you start.
Yes, no, I mean, we mourn the loss of Pope Francis, and certainly if you reflect about
his pontificate, he really was a kind of breaking the mold and trying to disassociate himself from the historical manifestations of the pontifical authority. So he did not want to live in the apostolic palace. He instead lived in the St. Martha house, which is essentially a hotel that John Paul II built for the cardinals when they would have to convene in the Sistine Chapel. He refused to use some of the more elaborate rituals and vestments of the pontificate. He did want to create an image of simplicity, which I think was in line with his style as Archbishop of Buenos Aires. And that's perfectly fine. Each pope has his own personality. But you do that at the risk of kind of minimizing the office itself in its public manifestations. In other words, people look up to their father and they respect in the way you speak to your father and the way you treat him, the honors that you give him. So a lot of these things were you know, honorifics given to him in order to highlight the fact that his authority comes from God and that we obey him not because he's a person of a specific origin, but because he is the successor of St. Peter.
Hmm. Bob, you'll remember Pope Francis paying the bill at his hotel after being elected. We have footage of that. His great devotion to mercy, carried his own bags, which became a fixture of any visit. Almost immediately, he shunned many of those traditional trappings, as Father said, the red cope and even the white pants the Pope traditionally wore. Pope Francis wore the black pants. You know, I always thought that was kind of a callback to his Jesuit origins. And the world loved this. How did Catholics receive it?
Well, I think that there was a kind of a threefold response to this. Yes, on the one hand, a lot of people liked the fact that he was a simpler, kind of an unusual figure from some place that very few people were familiar with, Argentina. But I think that that mostly was the case for people who don't pay a lot of attention to the Catholic Church. They got the impression of a smiling, genial, very charismatic figure. And he was able to convey that, I think, throughout his papacy, in spite of all the controversies, et cetera, that arose afterwards. But I think what began to divide people is that the, if we want to put it this way, the more progressive element in the church liked this because they thought other things were coming. I think the people who were more traditional looked at what he was doing and were fearful that this was a kind of a precursor of some changes in the church. And I think Father is exactly right that uncertainty about the way that he embraced the traditions reflects something that is a particular problem in the modern world. And I agree with Archbishop Chaput that it failed to address the real challenges of the church in the world right now, because it seemed like he was worried about presenting the church as simply exerting power, when in fact what the church really needs to do is recover authority. There's a lot of discussion in the secular world, for example, about, you know, is there authority still in democratic institutions or just political institutions mm-hmm. in general or cultural institutions? And while on the one hand it was a strong thing for him to do to try to present a different type of papacy, which of course he had any right to do, and he was the one who was going to have to carry out this program and he had to feel comfortable with it, but there's something different between Jorge Bergoglio, the man, and Pope Francis, the Pope.
And I want to pick up on a point you just mentioned there. Francis quickly began to establish, as you mentioned, Bob, the signature causes early in his pontificate that he would sort of carry the torch on. In July of 2013, he made his first apostolic visit to the Mediterranean island of Lampedusa, long considered a gateway for migrants on their way to Europe. Migration became one of the hallmarks of this papacy, right up until the condemnation of the second Trump administration's deportation of criminal aliens. Father, your thoughts on how issues like this and perhaps climate change dominated the papacy?
Yeah, the public face of the papacy included a heavy emphasis on issues of societal arrangements, we could say political decisions, who gets to emigrate, who gets the refugee status, who gets to enter the country. The whole emphasis about climate change, you know, the Holy See basically was saying all the science leads to the conclusion that man-caused climate change is happening, we've got to change that. There were all kinds of issues regarding social engineering, regarding the economy. The Pope essentially leaned toward a more socialistic controlled economy. He criticized capitalism. the Pope, unfortunately, from my point of view, neglected to speak about doctrinal and spiritual issues that are so important for modern man who has a crisis of faith, and spoke about political issues at great length. Now, he did say things about prayer and doctrine, but those aren't the ones that got the headlines and that kind of entered the consciousness of the faithful.
Yeah. And Bob, look, he was very pro-life. He was unwavering in his pro-life stance. He sort of ping-ponged on marriage. You know, on one hand, he'd be defending it. Then the other hand, he'd, you know, pass a papal document, which we'll talk about in a second. But in September of 2015, Pope Francis made an historic apostolic visit to Cuba, then to the United States, eventually New York, Washington, Philadelphia. We covered that visit in each of those cities. He became the first pope in history to address the joint session of Congress, and his visit was very well received at the time. Bob, your last memory, or lasting memory, rather, of that visit, and what impression did Pope Francis leave on America at that time?
Yeah, I think that some of the issues we were just talking about were already in play at that moment. And he looked like, as many people have said since, that he was bringing the church into the 21st century. I think that actually that was a misreading, because if we look at, to take the issue of immigration that you just brought up, every country in Europe and North America now realizes that that more open-handed approach to immigration is an impossibility. What struck me, and maybe the two of you remember this as well, is when he did his final mass at the World Meeting of Families in Philadelphia, which is supposed to be a celebration of marriage and family. And the reading of the day was, I believe, the passage where Christ counsels against divorce and remarriage, that he kind of cut that short and almost gave a homily that seemed to contradict it. So the sense of urgency that he had, and the impression that he gave was that these other issues were things that he was going to press within the church and outside. And even though, yes, he was very, very strong about abortion, he talked abortion is like hiring a hitman, there was no sense of urgency. And the papacy, certainly in the way it handled itself institutionally, didn't seek to advance that issue anywhere nearly as much.
Yeah, but Bob, in 2016, as Pope Francis was settling into his papacy, we saw the release of that controversial apostolic exhortation, it's called, papal document of teaching, Amoris Laetitia. And there was that infamous footnote, 351, which seemed to open the door to divorced and remarried Catholics without annulments to receive communion. But this was predicated, and Father Jerry, I want you to speak to this. This was predicated by the Synod on the Family that he called, where Cardinal Walter Casper proposed a very similar possibility that divorced and remarried Catholics could just go to communion. Father, tell us what happened with Amoris Laetitia and how that could impact the conclave.
Yes, Amoris Laetitia in that footnote said that in certain cases, people who are divorced and remarried could receive Holy Communion without an annulment. And people were shocked about it because John Paul II and Benedict said the exact opposite, as had all Christian moral history before that. There is no endorsement for people in an adulterous second relationship to be receiving Holy Communion. The popes issued it in the footnote. Some people said he really wasn't giving them permission. Well, the bishops of Buenos Aires issued a document saying that that's what it meant, communion for divorced and remarried. Mm-hmm. And the Pope put that document into the official register in the Vatican. So he made that quite clear where he stood. This is one of the main issues, along with the blessing of same-sex couples, that will need to be reversed by the next Pope, because it's creating moral confusion and doctrinal chaos in the Church. If you say that the Lord's words, what God has joined, man must not divide, means that if you take up a second wife or husband, you're committing adultery. That's what the Lord's words mean. Well, if you say, well, it doesn't matter, people in adulterous relationships are qualified to receive communion, you've overthrown Catholic moral theology and you've created doubt about, you know, exactly what does the Church teach. Same about blessing same-sex couples. You cannot say that two people who enter into a sexual relationship in the same sex, that they deserve and are able to be blessed because of what they call their love for each other. No. They're committing sin with each other. We don't bless that kind of relationship.
Yeah, and that document was Fiducia Supplicans, which he didn't pass really until 2023. So that was just a few years ago. But Bob, Cardinal Casper at the time, I remember, he said that Pope Francis was practicing a theology of the people, that he had instituted a revolution of mercy and love, and these elements we've just been discussing, they would be a part of that. Obviously, other cardinals suggested that he was distorting established church teaching. Your thoughts here, and where does it leave the legacy as well as the man who will follow him?
Yeah, I think that it will inevitably be clear that there was an overemphasis on mercy and reception, an underemphasis on truth and fidelity that this papacy has left us. And I agree with Father that those things in particular are going to have to be reversed. Look, I mentioned the homily at that Philadelphia meeting. For me, one of the things that stands out about this papacy is when the Holy Father decided that the Our Father could not read that when Jesus taught his apostles, lead us not into temptation. He changed the wording of that. And in France and in Italy now, they pray. We don't in English, we haven't changed our translation. But any classical scholar or biblicist would have warned him not to call for that change, because the Lord's words were what the Lord's words were. And the impression that I think all this adds up to, these changes that contradict things that have been taught forever, is that even Jesus' own words have to be corrected with a supplement of mercy. I mean, that simply can't be in the church. We have to remain faithful to what God himself has revealed. And we have to say God knows how to reveal what he wants for the human race.
Yeah. And there was also the change in the catechism on the death penalty as well, which we don't have time to get into, but we will in the coming days. Another major feature, and God knows we cover this almost week in and week out, of the Francis pontificate, is that infamous secret Vatican-China agreement, which allowed the CCP to have input in the appointment of Catholic bishops. And it also allows the distortion, I would say the perversion, of the gospel in Catholic worship in China, where you're inserting Mao and Xi into the gospel narratives, into the readings. This was first struck in 2018. It's been renewed several times. And I should also mention Cardinal Joseph Zen, the retired bishop of Hong Kong, who is 93, will be traveling to Rome to attend Pope Francis's funeral. Apparently his passport was returned to him so he can make the journey. Earlier this week, he made headlines with a statement critical of the Vatican's decision to call those first general congregation meetings so quickly after Pope Francis's death. Father, it's another perplexing, policy, the China agreement. So I want your reaction to that.
Yes. Well, the Pope repeated a few times during the pontificate that he was ready and willing and wanting to go visit China. So I think a lot of what he did with China was motivated by that desire. It is, in me, one of the worst things of the pontificate, and I'm sad to say that. I think the Pope made a tremendous mistake. The Chinese Communist Party has effective control over the nomination of bishops. And so what that means is an atheistic government that's has tried to suppress Christianity wherever it is, they control who becomes Catholic bishops. They've become state functionaries holding that position. Now, as you also mentioned, catechism is now being rewritten so that Chinese communist figures somehow have a role in the Christian faith. This is offensive. Children cannot be catechized. The dealings that Cardinal Zen had over the years with the communist government led him to understand on the ground what it's like to deal with communists. Yet he was not listened to when the Pope made these deals. So this deal has to be reversed. It is illegitimate, in my opinion, to give any secular power that is an atheist or communist regime any role in naming a Catholic bishop.
Yeah. Bob, we have to mention that the keeper of that secret China-Vatican agreement and one of the architects is the Vatican Secretary of State, Cardinal Pietro Parolin. Now, he lost his job when everybody else did, but he's one of the leading contenders to succeed Pope Francis. How does this deal affect his candidacy?
Well, I don't think people can be can overestimate how big a problem it is that he was central to this. And the Holy Father said repeatedly that he was the person who was on top of all the details of the arrangement. So he was central to this disastrous arrangement with a communist regime that very clearly would like to either stamp out or absorb the church into itself. Now, another wild card in this, of course, is that Cardinal McCarrick, was involved in those negotiations. He was sent by the Holy Father over there. He was still in somewhat of a good favor with the Vatican at that time. And I hope that eventually we will find out what kind of role he may have played in all of this. But I think ultimately, look, the authority for this goes back to the Holy Father. If he tells Parolin, I want a deal because we can't have this division between the church and the state forever, I guess he's going to have to carry it out. But to carry that out, I think, carries with it some serious baggage as we go into the next conclave. Mm.
Father, we have to remember the Pachamama controversy that occurred in October of 2019. That was the Synod of Bishops on the Amazon. And this pagan idol was displayed in the Vatican gardens as a precursor to the synod. It was later taken from a church by a young Australian Catholic layman who was enraged by it and threw it in the Tiber, or Austrian rather. It was an act for which Pope Francis later asked forgiveness. Father, I want you to couple this because we're very tight on time. This synod and the Pachamama controversy and the 2021 clampdown on the traditional Latin Mass, which the Pope did. He was particularly, a particular believer that the Latin Mass needed to go away. Your thoughts on all of that?
Sure. No, I think myself and other Catholic observers are stunned. You look at what the Pope did. He sat in the gardens while people from Latin America did a kind of ritualistic dance around a pagan idol statue. And then that statue was then brought into St. Peter's Basilica, allegedly under the inculturation motto, whereas that's not inculturation, that's paganism. Paganism, it has to be overcome. Thank God the Spanish missionaries were able to do that. So that was a mistake. Then you turn and say, wait a minute, the Mass that nourished the lives of saints, the traditional Latin Mass, is somehow harmful to the mission and the spiritual life of the Church, and we have to get rid of it. The Pope wrote in his document accompanying Traditionis Custodes that eventually everybody will have to leave the old Mass and come to the new Mass. Well, John Paul II and Benedict were of the opposite mind. They said if people are devoted to the worship over the centuries, doesn't the spirit of freedom of the sons of God teach us we should let them have that? So those mistakes, hopefully we're never going to see another Pachamama incident. Pagan rituals have no role in Christianity. We meant to stamp them out because they're leading people into sin and ignorance and blasphemy. And as regards the Latin Mass, if there's anything more necessary for the life of the Church, it's a greater reverence and worship. And the Latin Mass is what gives us that worship and reverence.
Bob, Pope Francis, we have to say it because it's true, with relentless intensity, he moved to stamp out the old Mass, drive it from parish life. Why did that Mass of the Ages, some call it the Mass of the Saints, which is attracting so many young people, why did it become a thing reviled and despised by Pope Francis and the people around him?
You know, I think that it's because it really asserts a strong sense of Catholic identity. At bottom, I think it's that. You can talk about inheritance from Vatican II or people who have particular views about liturgy. But I think ultimately it boils down to that. And, you know, if you look at Pachamama even in a larger context, it's kind of part of the same universalism that in a way Francis was pursuing. You remember that he signed this agreement with some Muslim leaders about God wills a plurality of religions. And that eventually had to be repudiated because, of course, this is precisely what is called universalism and indifferentism, that basically all religions are a path to God. And so Pachamama, even though she has a very dark history in Latin America prior to the arrival of the Spanish, that too can kind of be brought into the big tent. There's a reason why people don't feel an urgency of missionary work any longer, because if everybody is okay where they are, why should we go out to the missions? And I think that the fact that young people have been attracted so much to the Latin Mass may have contributed to this. I don't, by the way, we just had Easter and lots of young people came into the Catholic Church in France, in England, here in the United States. I did not see one article that said that this was the Francis effect. I think that everywhere that people looked into this, this was because young people are feeling adrift. The world is bereft of authority and sure signs of what to do with your life. And they're looking for something more substantial. And, of course, the Latin Mass is in part that.
Yeah, I've always been puzzled. I mean, I do think Pope Francis had a, you know, he wanted to bring people who felt estranged and far away from the faith into the flock. I do think he you know, and you see that when he went to the prisoners or when he went out, even to the immigrants, or when he went to the poor. I can't understand why he couldn't turn a merciful eye to those in his own flock, those who wanted reverence and sacrality. And as Bob said, you know, the kind of very vibrant and bold Catholic identity that became the enemy. And I still can't figure out why, but maybe in the days ahead, we can unpack that. Father Bob, I want to get to this before we run out of time. We almost are. The synods became a real hallmark of Pope Francis's pontificate. This idea of bringing everybody to the table around small groups, and suddenly cardinals were not allowed into these synods. It was an invite-only event. He would bring in atheists and non-believers and young kids and people from other communities and nuns. And it was kind of a grab bag. But the fact is there were a number of these, and it seems to be an effort to democratize the church, open it up, let others make the decisions. And in fact, just this week, here we see the beginning of the legacy, the German bishops issued a 4-page guide on how priests can bless couples in irregular unions, including same-sex relationships. But here's my question, Father. How will the synodal model carry into the next pontificate? Will it?
I hope it doesn't. I hope, in fact, that we return to what the Synod of Bishops really is, which is a meeting of bishops. You cannot have a Synod of Bishops in which other people, lay people, nuns, priests, deacons, that they have equal voting rights. Then it's no longer a synod. It's bishops meeting with other people, you can call it. The Synod on Synodality is an attempt to democratize the church, which is classical, sad to say, of modern political theory, where you undermine authority by saying, well, everyone has authority and we're all going to exercise it together. Meanwhile, who gets to pick the people who are present? Who gets to set up the discussion? Who gives the topics? Who tells you how to vote and when you can vote? No, the divine constitution of the church has to be reaffirmed. The bishops are collectively the successors of the apostles. Peter's successor is the pope. They are the shepherds of the flock. The flock does not tell the shepherds what to do. The shepherds tell the flock what to do. And what the shepherds are supposed to say is what Christ taught them. So this is the issue here. If you want to take opinions on what people think are important, I think that's great. I love more information. What I don't want is somebody saying, well, Mrs. McGillicuddy over here, she has the same vote as Cardinal Mueller at the next synod because her ideas about what church needs to do are important. She may have good ideas. She's not a shepherd of the church. Mm. So we got to get back.
Yeah.
This is sad to say, we have to reverse things in order to return to normalcy.
As long as you brought up Cardinal Gerhard Mueller, he warns this week that the church could face schism if the next pope elected is in the same ideological line as Pope Francis. Bob, I'll let you react to that and the synodal model that we've been covering for so long.
Yeah, look, we can only speculate at this point because we don't know who the next man is who's going to be the successor of Peter. But I think we can say with some certainty that unless he's a very close follower of Pope Francis, synodality is going to fade away, and it may fade away rather quickly. In fact, I think that the Pope realized toward the end that it didn't seem to be going anywhere fast, that, you know, we used to joke about the synodal process was about the process, that the synod is the process, and, you know, what is it aiming at outside of itself other than to perpetuate the process? And that may be the reason why he put off those hot-button issues until to June. There are these 10 special study groups that are supposed to report in June. Now they'll be reported to a different pope. And he put off until 2028 his synodal assembly, which I think he must have known he would not be alive to see. So I think we'll know very quickly. If we do get someone who is a second Francis, maybe it'll linger on, but I can't see what great effect it's going to have in the future because it's had a very, very weak past.
Mm-hmm. Gentlemen, there's so much more we could say. We could go on for 2 hours about this pontificate, but we have the days ahead to do that. For now, we join the rest of the church praying for the repose of Pope Francis's soul and for the church and the cardinals during this interregnum period, a very important one. We will, of course, keep you up to date with all the happenings from Rome. You can follow my X account at Raymond Arroyo for more information. We will see you all next week. And you can find Robert Royal's incredible new book, Martyrs of the New Millennium, at bookstores, everywhere, online. Go and grab a copy. Our Interregnum and Conclave coverage will continue next week. And follow us on social media. We'll keep you up to date. Father, Bob, we will convene the posse in Rome. And the Arroyo Grande podcast made some news with actor Jim Caviezel this week. He spoke candidly about the pain and the purpose he found playing Jesus in Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ. He also talks about playing the role again in The Resurrection and a never-before-heard story of his near-death experience. Take a look.
The last shot of the movie, I got ripped right in half from that lightning bolt. And then two heart surgeries.
You think that that's what contributed to the heart problems?
100%.
The lightning strike and the hypothermia and the...
Well, that was AFib. When I was on the cross, the doctor put the stethoscope on my heart and he turned to Mel. He said he could die. And
two heart surgeries.
Yes. And a full on open heart. And I came out of surgery. I had the tubes, you know, and you're like, you know, it's rough because you can't talk and you got all these tubes in your throat and everything. And all of a sudden, boom, it's like, someone took an egg and cracked it on the lower right side. Oof. I died right there. And my heart shut off. The doctors ran into the room and I watched them. I was out of body experience. I watched the whole thing. I told them, I watched all of you when you were in the room when I was dead. And they, you know, not all of them believe the way we believe, but they were like, I could tell them everybody. I told them what they were doing in the room. I watched it, and I felt the most peace, and I felt the most love, and then they brought me back, and then I felt the most pain.
Yeah, then you got the most pain again. Then you're back, full circle moment. The full Arroyo Grande interview with Jim Caviezel is on YouTube at Arroyo Grande Show. Just type in Arroyo Grande Show at YouTube. It's free even to subscribe, and you can see it there or listen wherever you get your podcasts. And this past week would have been Mother Angelica's 102nd birthday. So I decided to pay tribute to Reverend Mother and recalled the miracles of her life and how we can copy her example. Two great Easter episodes on the Arroyo Grande podcast. Be sure to check them out. You can visit RaymondArroyo.com. All the links are there. Joining me now with his thoughts and reflections on the passing of Pope Francis earlier this week is the president of the Catholic League, Bill Donahue. Bill, thank you for being here. Your initial thoughts on the loss of Pope Francis, and what did you think immediately when you heard the news?
Well, I was woken up by reporters at 4:20 a.m. on Monday, and so I was a little bit surprised, but I wasn't shocked. I said to the staff here a couple of weeks ago, how many times have we seen a person, or for that matter, an animal, a dog, when you're not doing well and you're failing and you're close to death, they rebound. They do. They rebound for a short period of time and everybody gets their hopes up and then they go the other way. So was I surprised? Yes. Was I shocked? No.
In your column on the Catholic League website this week, you write movingly about Pope Francis's down-to-earth persona and his appeal to Catholics and non-Catholics alike. As a fellow media watcher, what did you initially make of the loose, spontaneous style of Jorge Bergoglio back in 2013 at the dawn of his pontificate? And how do you see it now? Has it changed at all?
I think he got off to a much better start. And I think as time went on, he wanted to make more changes than his authority would allow. He ran up against a brick wall called scripture and tradition. And the question is this, you know, it's one thing to say, I want to reach out to the marginalized. It's another thing that are you going to ratify some of the behaviors of the marginalized? And by the way, while Pope Francis gets all kinds of credit for reaching out to the marginalized, the fact of the matter is he actually marginalized a lot of Catholics themselves. I'm talking about traditionalists. Mm-hmm. Let me give you a couple of quick examples. We know that he basically declared war on the Latin Mass. We know, for example, that he welcomed in Jeanine Gramic and others who clearly were dissidents and who rejected the church's teachings and who were, in fact, sanctioned by the Catholic Church from Rome and from the USCCB here in the United States. So that's where the moral confusion comes in. When those people who are practicing fidelity, the loyal sons and daughters of the Catholic Church, are marginalized, and people who are at war with the Church's teachings and have been for decades are embraced, people begin to wonder, don't we need some clarity here?
Yeah. You know, it's amazing. And look, I think now is the time you want to also, before you bury the Pope, you want to point to positive things in his legacy. So one of those things was the freewheeling press conferences held on those papal planes during his apostolic visits. Now, on the one hand, the media of the world said, oh, look, we can ask questions of the Pope. He'll talk back quickly. There's an immediate response, which was a wonderful thing. And the Vatican communications apparatus did move at a quicker clip than in years gone by. However, it often stoked controversy as well, got him into some hot water. Your thoughts on the occasional imprecision of those comments and the need for clarification in many cases. Is that the natural trade-off when you're freelancing and available to the press and the world?
I think it is. And one of the things I've been telling the media this week is that whether people like it or not, even though Trump and Pope Francis were not exactly friends, I think that's not a secret, they had some things in common stylistically. Both of them were refreshing because they weren't scripted and they were transparent and they were off the cuff. They spoke from the heart. And people like that as opposed to the tight-lipped people in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. and in Rome, whom you see. On the other hand, it does get you into trouble. I remember Cardinal George, obviously before he passed away, told Pope Francis, listen, you're no longer the Archbishop of Buenos Aires. You're the Pope, and you've got to be more disciplined in your rhetoric. But he simply had his own way of going about things. I do think, in fairness to him, he didn't have the greatest street smarts, and some of the reporters on the papal plane kind of baited him, and he kind of took the bait, and then they set things up, and then the next day the Vatican is walking it back. So he was refreshing. I like that about Pope Francis, but sometimes when you come that blunt, you pay a price for it.
Yeah, no, I like that too. The immediacy of that, the energy of that was something, and obviously gave us lots to cover. The media were generally very fair, if not fawning, toward Pope Francis, as you write in your column. But talk to me about that infamous phrase, "Who am I to judge?" which has become kind of one of the major hallmarks and touchstones of this pontificate. Bill, how was that remark actually misquoted? It was about a particular Monsignor Rica, who is still running to this day the Santa Marta house, the house the cardinals will be living in during this conclave.
It was wildly mischaracterized by almost every segment of the media. What the Pope was asked is about a particular priest. Charges were made against him. Did he violate his vow of chastity? And the Pope answered, you know, is he a homosexual? He says, who am I to judge him? They left out the pronoun him. He wasn't saying, who am I to judge acts of homosexuality? He never said that. In fact, to the contrary, to his credit, Pope Francis condemned homosexual acts. He was talking about a particular person, but the media wanted to get into the head of the Pope and Catholics and non-Catholics. Oh, the church is changing radically, precipitously. They're going to welcome in homosexuality. No, it's one thing to say, if you are a person who happens to be a homosexual, you are a child of God, just like as if you're a heterosexual. But if you're a straight guy, you engage in adultery. Or if you're a gay guy and you engage in sodomy, that's against the church's teaching. So these distinctions have to be kept clear. And at least many people, not all, in the media know the difference, but they had an agenda.
You've been watching the media treatment of the sex abuse crisis, really, since this broke back in 2003, Bill. Your thoughts on the way Pope Francis handled these sex abuse cases, from his refusal to publish the name of priests accused to the zero tolerance policy he originally adopted and codified into law, and what some would call his blind spots regarding friends like Bishop Zanchetta, Gustavo Zanchetta, and that disgraced Jesuit artist, Marco Rupnik, who's charged with, you know, doing unspeakable things to a whole group of nuns. I won't get into it, but your thoughts on this part of his legacy.
Well, I think that, listen, they should have listened to him in the United States as well as around the world when he said, do not publish the names of accused priests. I've been making that argument for years. And when people in the media have challenged me, let me tell you something. I'm with Pope Francis 100%. Is there any institution in the secular world, never mind religious institutions, at NBC, CBS, they've had a lot of problems over there, New York Times, go right down the line. Do any of them ever publish the names of people who are on staff who are accused of a sexual impropriety? No. So why should we be the ones out there? A lot of these guys are dead, and a lot of them were innocent, and we're not. And they're not there to defend themselves. So I think that was the best thing that Francis did with regard to the sexual abuse thing. There's no question that the real hero in cleaning up the church wasn't Francis, and it wasn't John Paul II, great as he was. That went to Pope Benedict XVI. He did more to really take care of this issue and forthrightly, and he doesn't get the credit any more than Pope Francis doesn't get credit. Now, his blind spots were huge, and I'll leave it to others to try to account for Rupnik and Zanchetta. I just don't understand it myself. I have personally brought charges against people I suspected were engaged in sexual improprieties when I was a professor. And I'm not looking for any medals about that. But when you see something's wrong and you know something's wrong, you don't ignore it. Too many of the bishops were afraid it got in public, and therefore they're more concerned about the reputation of the church instead of correcting the problem.
We've got to talk a bit about Francis's consistent, you mentioned this earlier, his consistent and strong defense of life and the unborn. He was unwavering on those areas, as well as his acknowledgement of the presence of evil, the reality of the devil. Your reflections on that?
Nobody spoke more eloquently and consistently about the existence of the devil and what he's doing in the church and outside the church than Pope Francis. And when it came to abortion, he used words like murder and compared it to hitmen in the mafia. He was much stronger in his rhetoric than either of his two predecessors, both of whom were great men. And let's remember this. When it comes to gender ideology, the insane idea that you can change your sex through an operation by simply identifying yourself if you want, the Pope actually used the word demonic. So no, I don't think he gets enough credit. And I think there's a reason for that. The media really wanted to play up his social justice end of his thinking. That kind of vision. Mm-hmm. So they didn't want to get it out there that he took a different position on homosexuality than they would take, or on gender ideology, or on abortion. No, the Pope was consistent on that. The media didn't want to play that up because they wanted to try and pump him up as the social justice champion and have him go down that road even further.
Yeah, it's almost like the media is trying to shape Francis into John the 23rd, the second. Remember, John the 23rd also, he was hardly as radical as he's often depicted or remembered because of the media accounts. And you see the reshaping of Francis's legacy happening before our eyes, mostly fueled by images of him kissing babies or people with disfigurements or you know, going to the prisons and that sort of thing. But the reality is, and Bill, we have to say this, we were there for that. I was there personally. John Paul II was the one that broke down many of these, the distance between the world and the papacy by going out into the world. It was John Paul that would go to the prisons and would go visit his assassin and, you know, surprise the world in so many ways. And I do worry that memories are so short. They claim that Francis is the guy who broke down all these barriers. He really wasn't. He wasn't even the first green pope. That would be Benedict XVI, too, who put solar panels on the top of Paul VI's hall. But your thoughts on some of the decisions in foreign affairs, Bill, chiefly that Vatican-China agreement that we talked about earlier with the posse, and recently the pope's willingness to wade into U.S. politics by criticizing immigration policy.
Well, yeah, I mean, when he called for the international investigation in Israel, did it commit genocide by defending itself against what happened on October 6th? That startled people. He clearly seemed to be more at home with the Chinese communist regime than with some Americans. Biden, for example, was clearly pro-abortion, pro-gender ideology. I don't remember the Pope lashing out against him. Trump wasn't in office about a week, and he was lashing out against him in terms of immigration. So I think there's some inconsistencies here. But look, you have to be judged on the totality of your works. And I often say this to people. There's a profound difference between intent and effect. I don't question the Pope's intent whatsoever on anything. Now, like anybody else, you're free to say, I'm critical in terms of the effects of the policies which he's embraced. It's one thing to say, I show compassion for the poor. It's another thing to rail against market economies, which have done more to alleviate the poor than socialism, which has done more to punish the poor. And yet the Pope showed an affinity for socialism much more than he did for capitalism. Economic theory and practice was not his strong suit. So I have to look at the totality of that, too.
You know, Bill, when you said it a moment ago, it resonated with me. We're talking about a legacy that is in many ways a contradiction. There was not a single through line. The Pope often contradicted either in word or action something he had just written or said. And everybody would kind of have to keep their head on a swivel the whole time. But it was a fascinating papacy to watch, as you said. It was vibrant. It was from the hip. That was its blessing and maybe its curse when it came to doctrine and clarifying doctrine. What will his lasting legacy be in your mind? And what do you think he'll be most remembered for?
I think it's going to divide, unfortunately, a little bit along left-right lines. I mean, he didn't talk about moral relativism the way his predecessors did. And indeed, he added to the confusion in terms of Catholic moral teachings. On the other hand, those people who prefer the social justice end clearly will champion him for the poor and reaching out to the marginalized. I think it's one thing to reach out to people who feel disaffected. It's quite another if you get into it. Gets very tricky if those people whom you're reaching out to who are disaffected are in their own behavior engaged in acts which the church has not accepted. It's difficult. A lot of people walk away a little bit confused about that. And again, I get back to the situation where if you're a traditionalist and you're a Latin Mass devotee and you feel unwelcome, how well does it sell that you reached out to the marginalized, many of whom were dissident Catholics? So, I do think we need a gentle push of the pendulum back to the middle and a little bit more of the traditionalist style, keeping some of the better parts of what Pope Francis's legacy has yielded.
Thank you, Bill Donahue. Follow the work of the Catholic League as well as commentary by Bill Donahue at CatholicLeague.org. Thank you, Bill.
Thank you.
The new documentary, Carlo Acutis, Roadmap to Reality, will arrive in theaters April 27th in cinemas across the country from Fathom Events. Roadmap to Reality takes us on a journey through the life of this soon-to-be saint. The Italian teen will become the first member of the millennial generation to be declared a saint by the Catholic Church. And though the Acutis canonization has been postponed due to the death of Pope Francis, why is now the perfect time for the film's release? Here to tell us, I'm joined by producer Jim Wahlberg. Jim, thanks for being here. Great to have you back. You had a hit Eucharistic documentary last year. What inspired you to take on this latest doc about this young teenager, Carlo Acutis, soon to be Saint Carlo Acutis?
I was approached on the story, to be quite honest. I knew very little about Carlo. I was approached by a gentleman. I was speaking at a Catholic men's conference in Beaumont, Texas. And a gentleman approached me and said, I want to make a movie. And I said, everybody wants to make a movie. And he said, I'm inspired by this young man. And he built a camp. They have a foundation and they built a camp for Catholic children. And in the centerpiece of the camp is a chapel, which he allowed Bishop Toops from Beaumont to name. He named it Blessed Carlo Acutis Chapel. And that was the first that my friend had heard of Carlo himself. So he started to investigate and started to develop a devotion, if you will, to Carlo, to the point where he flew to Assisi to meet with Carlo's family. And ultimately, Carlo's mom came to Beaumont and spoke to parishioners there. I said, it's very expensive. He said, what does it cost? You tell me what you paid for your last film. And I gave him a number and he said, okay, I'm in, just like that. And so started the journey. Yeah. And so started the journey. And now you only have to take a few steps into the story to realize the subject matter. Yes, this film is a film about a Catholic saint, but this is a very secular issue as well, right? Young people and electronics, social media, and being lost in this digital, I call it the new digital divide, right? It's taking people, these young people, away from their families, away from their friends, away from reality, if you will. And so this film is really Carlo in action. So we learn all about Carlo, but the backstory that's going on is there's a group of Catholic high school children from North Dakota going on pilgrimage to walk the footprints of Carlo. And they find out 2 days before they're leaving, Raymond, that they cannot take their electronics with them. You want
to talk
about
to tell you. You told them they couldn't. They had to disengage, turn over their phone, leave their phones at home. Yeah. Tell me about the making of the movie. And what did the students learn from relinquishing the cell phone? I imagine this was a little traumatic for them for a couple of days.
Well, traumatic is an understatement. But I'll tell you this, we meet these kids in the beginning. When they find out that they're going on the trip, they're not that impressed. They're not that excited. They're not very faithful. They're Catholic high school kids that the story after story was, well, my parents are Catholic. I don't know if I believe this or, you know, I don't know what I believe. Mm. We get those electronics away from them and they go to Rome and Assisi and they have to engage. And so when they engage in the beauty of our faith, of our Holy Mother Church, and then they come to Carlo's tomb, these young people have, many have very real conversion experiences as a result of this pilgrimage, and just as much as a result of getting that phone out of their hands.
Wow. Carlo was considered a computer geek, owing, I know, to his love of technology. Yeah. And he created a website on Eucharistic miracles, which cataloged Marian apparitions as well. Do you see any parallels to your documentary, Jesus Thirsts, and this one on the life of Carlo Acutis?
What's such a great question, Raymond. And you have a great memory from our last conversation about that film, right? So when we started that process, I wasn't that keen on wanting to do a film on the Eucharistic revival, right? I wasn't sure that, I couldn't figure out why does the Eucharist need revival, right? But so I wanted to spend all the time on that film looking at Eucharistic miracles and proving the true presence of Jesus in the Eucharist. And, you know, what we found out in doing research was 70% of the people in the pews did not, they believed that it was a symbol, not the true presence. Now, I took it a step further, and there's 70% of the people missing from the pews as well. So these are people that actually go to church, and they don't believe in the true presence. And so a huge problem, a huge problem. And, you know, I spoke to a friend, Dr. Scott Hahn. I called him. I was chasing him around trying to ask him to be in the film. And he called me back on a Sunday afternoon. I was at the park, and I'm not allowed to be on the phone on a Sunday afternoon in the park with my family. But I looked down and saw it was him, so I went behind a tree. And I said, you know, I wanna, you know, he said, tell me about your film, Jim. And I said, I wanna prove to people that it's not just a symbol. I want to prove to them the true presence. I want to look at all these Eucharistic miracles. And he said, the most interesting thing, he said, Jim, maybe instead of spending so much time on Eucharistic miracles, we could spend some time on the miracle of the Eucharist. And I was just like, this is why I love you, Dr. Hahn. This is why I want you in my film. So yes, proving to young people is critical. Proving to, if 70% of the people don't believe in the true presence, I'm not sure what, like, it's mind-boggling to me. It is mind-boggling to me. What? Why are you there?
Jim, before we run out of time, we know that Pope Francis's passing has paused the canonization ceremony for Carlo Acutis. Approximately 1,000 theaters across the country, however, will show the documentary the same day Pope Francis was supposed to make Carlo a saint. Why is it still important to you to release the movie? Why are you going forward with it?
Well, there's a variety of reasons. As far as I'm concerned, he is a saint, right? Now it's a matter of, you know, the event itself, right? But he's been declared a saint, technically, to me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that we're in desperate times, and young people and parents and families need to see this film. They need to see the dangers and difficulties and what's happening to these young people. These young kids on pilgrimage, they looked at their phones and jokingly they said, "You ever look at how much time in the day you spend on the phone?" And one said, 6.5 hours. And the next person said, "Oh, that's nothing. 8 hours for me. 8 hours looking at a device. Wow. 8 hours disconnected from reality, disconnected from their families, their friends, and from their faith."
Yeah. Jim, before I let you go, your thoughts on the passing of Pope Francis and the fact that so many young people who came to Rome for the Acutis canonization will probably stay for Pope Francis's funeral this weekend.
And most marginalized. You know, with immense gratitude, I woke up for his example, on Monday to the news, and it was a lot. It's a lot, you know. It's a lot to lose the Holy Father, right? It's a lot. But I want to talk more about the gift that he leaves us, which is we are now front and center around the world. Everybody's talking about the Catholic Church and the Catholic faith. What a gift that is, that we are front and center on the minds and lips of everybody across the world right now.
Well, I'm glad your film is going to benefit from that instead of just that Conclave cockamamie movie that was out a few months ago.
Worst thing I ever
Carlo
saw in
Acutis.
My life.
It's horrible. Carlo Acutis, Roadmap to Reality, produced by Jim Wahlberg and directed by Tim Moriarty, hits select theaters nationwide Sunday, April 27th, and it runs through Tuesday, April 29th from Fathom Events. Visit carloacutisfilm.com. For more info about the tickets, theaters, and showtimes. Jim Wahlberg, thank you for being here.
Raymond, thank you. God bless you.
That is all the time we have for now. Be sure to catch us next week. We'll really begin our coverage of the interregnum and eventual conclave to elect Pope Francis' successor. Before we go, I want to wish a very happy birthday to our associate producer, Rita Sporlitter. Thank you for all you do for the show each week, and enjoy your special day. In the meantime, may Pope Francis rest in peace. We will be scouting the world over for all that is seen and unseen. On behalf of the staff and crew of EWTN News, thank you for watching. I'm Raymond Arroyo. Bye now.